Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is graphic designer, editor-in-chief of SoCal Magazine, and gay bar aficionado, Randy Dunbar. So welcome to the show, Randy.
Thank you very much.
I'm really kind of excited to talk about some of the bars that you mentioned to me because a number of them have kind of fallen by the wayside so far. We haven't heard much from the people I've interviewed. And it looks like your experience is mostly in Los Angeles, starting in maybe the late 60s to 1970-ish.
Yes. I graduated high school in 1969. I guess we'll just get that out of the way. And yeah, and I do want to just preface it by saying, you know, bars were a part of my life, but they were not my life. I mean, I've seen some people that seem like that's what they did. In your youth, you go to bars. And as I mentioned, I think the first bar that I might have stepped in, but I don't really have a recollection, was a bar called Gino's on Melrose. My gay brother, who was 5 years older, he was often caught there, which was scandalous, of course. Having a gay brother was scandalous, too.
Yeah, especially at that time.
Yes, especially at that time. Well, he paved the way. Yeah. My mother was used to it by then.
As you said, you know, for you, gay bars weren't really your life. They were just
I do want to emphasize, because I personally appreciated what I wrote about. And I'll try to say it as eloquently as I thought I wrote it. But, you know, these gay bars were also places where, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about this, where, you know, at the end of the night, one went home in a car with a great deal of longing and lust and loneliness. So it wasn't all happiness. You know, gay bars were also places where you had crushes on people that were never met. You know, so there's a whole other side to it. You know, yes, the dancing was great. It was fun. You went with your friends. But there is a whole other side, because I do believe at that point, people went to bars to pick up.
That is probably very true. Although from my experience and the research that I've done on this project, for a lot of people, it opened their eyes to a lifestyle that they could actually live comfortably, that they may not have known about, especially people who went to their first gay bar in the 50s or 60s or even the 70s. Because
true.
No matter what size city you grew up in, you kind of felt like an outcast. And the bars were like a community center. Even if you didn't go to get drunk or didn't go to get laid, you went to feel like you were a real person, like you had some value in the community.
And it's a terrible admission to confess that everything you just said was not, at least on my radar. There was somewhat of a presumption, you know, it was like it was 1970, and you just went to a gay bar and you didn't really think too much because you didn't know too much about the things that you're talking about, which was, you know, now you look back and there's I saw some just the other day, you know, footage of people who were getting arrested in a gay bar. It never crossed our minds in Los Angeles that we were going to get arrested going to a gay bar.
Now, you mentioned that your brother used to go to Gino's, and that was kind of a cool, hip place. But your first bar experience was actually at a bar called The Farm.
This is true.
And that was also somewhat iconic. I've known about it for a while, but it was only around for about 3 or 4 years, I think. It wasn't a long-lived bar.
I don't remember how distinctly. I remember I was in college. I was meeting all the people who became my best friends, and we used to go to the bar. I ran into my brother at that bar. That was often very funny. I remember there was sawdust on the floor. There were peanuts on the bar. And I think the best part about it was they had a big backyard with a big bonfire kind of thing. But it was a period of people taking Quaaludes or something like that. And people would often fall down those stairs. It wasn't me, but people, you know, it was just a very funny period, you know, probably early 70s, where people were taking downers and, you know, drinking and taking downers, not a good combination, and falling down that staircase at the farm. And I believe what happened was if memory serves me, it was like around 11 o'clock, these barn doors literally opened and it became a dance bar.
Very cool. I understand also in late 1970, and this might have been before you actually stepped foot in there the first time, but in like September of 1970, the Gay Liberation Front organized a touch-in there. It was actually part of their way of flaunting their gayness at the police and so on. And they went, they had a protest event at the farm.
Really? Did not know that. I missed it.
Supposedly from...
What was a touch-in? What did you touch?
Well, because you weren't allowed to touch each other in a bar. Supposedly, if the police came by and they saw two men holding hands or touching each other, that it was a cause for arrest for lewd conduct or whatever the charge
was. Right.
And okay. So this was their way of... It's kind of like a kiss-in, but without kissing.
Okay. Sure.
Now, there's also rumors that the bar was owned by the mafia.
Well, there were rumors that every gay bar was owned by the mafia. That was just sort of de rigueur thinking that, you know, every bar you went to, mostly because of the liquor license, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and there
it was
were
very expensive.
There's a couple of gay historians and researchers who have done some work on that. And have actually written books about the connection between the mafia and the gay bar scene.
Right.
So.
Well, that I don't know, and I didn't do anything. If they're listening.
So the farm was kind of maybe a little bit of a dive type bar. It wasn't at all glamorous or glitzy. It was down to earth.
You know, there was, and it may hold true. Don't really know. There was sort of this legend, and I mean legend like in terms of a map, which was, you know, West Hollywood, which would be, let's say, west of San Vicente, was the younger crowd. This was still in West Hollywood. This was on Santa Monica Boulevard between Fairfax and Crescent Heights. But it was a much more, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years older. Everything kind of got put into its section based on age. So once you went west towards West Hollywood, that's where you had the younger bars like Blue Parrot. That's where Studio One ultimately emerged. This bar was literally on Santa Monica Boulevard, right across the street from the French Market. And there is a bar there today. It is not a gay bar, but there is a bar there today.
Now, speaking of Studio One,
yes.
That is perhaps the most iconic bar from West Hollywood back in the day. I've heard people refer to it as the Studio 54 of California.
Of the West Coast.
The yep. West Coast. And it was a fabulous structure. Before we start talking about that, I want to show this little video clip from the trailer to a new movie called Studio One Forever by Mark Saltarelli. So people get an idea of what the bar was like. And then we
absolutely.
So here's the clip.
Okay, guys, used to be paradise.
Wow. It was an explosion, a complete immersion.
I never thought there would be a place for me to be myself.
Studio! One, die!
Anybody who tells you that they were there in the 70s and remembers it wasn't there.
People were doing coke on the dance floor. They had little bottles. They just...
First it was fun, then it was fun with problems, and then it was just problems.
Most of the guys were shirtless. When you crossed over into the threshold of the dance floor, was a kind of alternative reality.
God bless Studio One forever.
It's amazing that they even had video footage from those clubs.
Had I only known.
So Studio One, in contrast to other bars like the Farm, was a massive structure.
Massive, yes.
My research indicates that it was opened up, I think, in the 1920s as the Mitchell Film Company. It was a big camera and film operation that serviced the Hollywood in the days when the studios were out there.
Right.
And it was a prefab building. It was not, you know, a traditional construction. It was a prefab industrial type building that served as the film company. And then later, I think, as a warehouse of some sort, and eventually became known as a nightclub by the name of Factory.
That's correct. I went there.
And then after Factory, an unlikely candidate in the area, Beverly Hills optometrist, stepped up and said, I want to turn this into a fabulous gay bar. So why don't you tell us about your connection with that?
Well, let me correct you. He was not a Beverly Hills optometrist, as far as I know. He was my optometrist, as a matter of fact. His offices were very near the farm, so he was in middle West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard. He was my optometrist. He gave me my first contact lenses, which I dreaded and hated. And my relationship to Studio One was, you know, I was a client of his, getting my contact lenses. He knew that I was interested in graphic design. He must have told me about a nightclub that he was doing. I, at this point, had been, and some of my friends have framed them, I was designing envelopes. I would write a lot of letters and I would design the envelopes, and they were very artistic and graphic. And I must have shown him one, and I probably volunteered and just said, look, here's a sketch for Studio One. And that ultimately became the logo for Studio One. My other connection, which is a kind of a very, it's almost bizarre to me that this happened, was apparently Scott Forbes was on The Dating Game, and I went with him and his family to the taping. Why? I don't know. I can't really recall, other than standing in line on Beverly Boulevard, CBS, and Scott, he didn't win, I believe, but Scott Forbes was on The Dating Game. Huh. Little known fact.
That seems kind of odd.
It does. But I'm telling you, that's what I have a pretty good memory. So I'm certain that happened. But anyway, yes, that became the logo. And Studio One in West Hollywood was the largest. It was literally two floors, although one floor was just an entrance. And then you went up a staircase. My experiences there, you know, Studio One, yes, indeed, was a dance club, but it had the back lot, which was really, really incredible. I had an evening there with Madam. I went to Madam's creator's home later that night. Nothing happened, but, you know, that's the kind of, you know, it was the 70s. And the back lot was entertainment, and then in the front was the dance part. One of my great evenings was watching Sal Mineo walk in. That was kind of great. Had a crush on him. And, you know, celebrities were there, and it was huge, and the dancing was great. Scott was very, he hired a lot of young beauties from the 70s. And so you had people that worked there were all quite attractive, and they were everywhere wearing these little skimpy outfits. It was the 70s, and people started working out around 1978, so they were looking good. And the other event that was, again, kind of very strange was me and my friend Richard Velasco dancing to Chuck Berry on a Sunday afternoon tea dance there.
Who knew? I understand they also hosted a number of benefits and fundraisers there over the years, that they were very interactive. And if I'm not mistaken, was it Joan Rivers? Who was the one that did the fundraiser there, one of the early AIDS fundraisers at Studio One?
I believe it was Joan Rivers. Yeah, they did a lot. It was, again, it was mostly the back lot, which was just such a great nightclub, really, really one of its kind. And a lot of people performed there. I know for me, I loved going to the back lot.
Now, was the back lot, I've read about it, and I've seen ads for it and things. The back lot was kind of like a show bar or drag bar extension of Studio One.
I would not call it a drag bar. It was entertainment, and it became quite famous in its time. It was a nightclub. That's all it was. So you have to understand, the layout of Studio One was this: you walked in up the stairs, there was a bar, then there was a very large dance area, and then there was a slight hallway, and that led into a smaller area, which was a nightclub, and that was called the back lot. And you had a lot of, you know, pretty much a lot of entertainment, very famous entertainment that would come to that event at that location.
And it was designed for entertainment. I mean, it had a stage and everything else back there.
I mean, you do have to give Scott credit. You know, it's like, you know, to think of, oh, nightclub, dance area, you know, he found a perfect spot. He handled it really, really well, and he managed it really well for a long, long time.
And you still live in L.A.?
I still live in L.A. I had a spell in New York in the unbelievable 80s in New York.
The reason I asked that question is I've, over the last few years, read quite a number of articles about the efforts to save the Factory/Studio One building.
Correct.
And my understanding that the latest incarnation of that plan is that a developer bought the property and he was planning on tearing it down and building a high-rise apartment multi-use complex. And then somehow came to a revelation when he realized that it was a prefab building, that it could be disassembled as easily as it was assembled, and that he actually disassembled the building and saved the parts. The building is still in storage, from my understanding.
Is that right? I did not know that. And it makes sense.
The complex there, from what I've read, was called the new complex. Is called Robertson Lane.
Okay.
And it's going to be a multi-building, multi-use complex. But there are plans to reconstruct the original factory building in a slightly different location on that same plot of land that he assembled and make it into a memorial to the bar as well as use it for other purposes. So my understanding is that that building will, in fact, still be in existence.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, because it was big. It was really, really big. So it'd be interesting to see how they're going to locate it in terms of what's going on there.
Yeah, and I'll put up a picture of what the proposed plan is. There's even a building I've seen in the architect's drawings that is called the factory.
Right. Because it's become prime real estate. It's ironic. I grew up off of Robertson Boulevard. So when I was a 9 or 10 or whatever it was, me and my neighbor, we got lost and we had to ring the doorbell of somebody in West Hollywood because we were so lost. It was foretelling, I guess.
Now, another one of your gay bar experiences from LA.
Yes.
Is another iconic nightclub. It was actually, I believe, in the Silver Lake area, and it was called Oil Can Harry's.
It's not Silver Lake. It is Silver Lake. Silver Lake, in terms of what I mentioned earlier, is where you went when you were past 40. This was a bar in the Valley on Ventura Boulevard. It only closed during COVID, and there's still some discussion about that. And it was not as big as Studio One. It was certainly not as glamorous. They were somewhat famous for having country and Western dances. And then it became a bar where if you loved disco music, this is, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. If you loved disco music, that is where you went, because there was a man with a fan still dancing to the disco music. So, and it was a great, great place to dance. I think, as I mentioned, it was the first place, you know, one of the hallmarks in the life of a gay man is when you take your shirt off when you're dancing. And I remember doing that once in New York. And the first time was in Oil Can Harry's. It had to have been like, you know, 76 or something like that.
Yeah,
you know, where you just had enough confidence to take off. No, it actually had to have been later. We started working out in 78. It was probably 79.
They opened in 68.
Yes,
and they
long time.
They remained open until last year, until 2020. They closed down for COVID, and as I understand it now, the building has been demolished. I don't think.
Sorry to hear that.
They have definitely announced that they are gone.
Right,
but the building is gone, from what I understand. And Oil Can Harry's, I don't know if they're connected or not. You may know better because you were there. I'm pretty sure that was the original one, right?
That was the original, yes.
But there was also one in San Francisco at one point. And there is still currently an Oil Can Harry's in Austin, Texas. And I don't know if they're related. They all have similar, well, the two in California had very similar logos.
Right.
The one
that kind of Gold Rush logo. Yeah.
And some of them had like a, I don't know, Oil Baron or Gold Baron or something with a top hat. And,
yes, that's their logo.
But the one in Austin doesn't really use anything like that anymore. In fact, I think they use just the letters OCH
as right.
primary label. But I'm curious to find out if they're related. I haven't found anybody who can answer that question for me yet. And none of the literature indicates whether they were or whether somebody in Texas just had been to L.A. and said, hey, this is a cool name for a bar. Let's steal it.
Well, again, you know, when did you say it started? What year?
68 in L.A.
That's pretty early. So, you know, there was always in gay life, there was always this attraction to I call it Gold Rush. But, you know, miners and, you know, there was a bar in West Hollywood, you know, the Gold Coast. It's an interesting aspect of gay life, this attraction to that particular aspect of life.
There are a number of names that are relate to manly endeavors, I guess you would say.
Maybe that's what it is, manly endeavors.
Because there was even one called the Gandy Dancer, which refers to people who worked on the railroads.
Right. Yeah.
So it's but there's plenty of mining companies all over the place. There's a company in.
Oh, that's right. There was a Yukon Mining Company, which was a restaurant on Santa Monica Boulevard.
And there was a company out of Dallas, Texas, who owned, I think, five or six different bars called Mining Company. There was the Tarrant.
Right. Company,
the San Antonio Mining Company, the Montrose Mining Company. They had all kinds. And Throckmorton Mining Company, I think, is still open there in Dallas.
Huh.
So mining companies were popular too.
I hadn't thought about that. It's a really interesting way of looking at a particular aspect of these bars or the culture at that time.
Well, and it was, I think they were usually related to the bars that were more men's bars, you know, more, they weren't designed for kids or, you know, teenagers or young.
Right. Yes.
The more mature bars that men wanted to be men, or they felt because of their upbringing in the 40s and 50s that they had to present a masculine appearance. So they didn't want something called the Pink Butterfly. They wanted something that had a, you know, a more manly name.
Right.
I'm not sure what the...
You know, I want to bring it that you've kind of reminded me of something, and I hope it's not off topic or, you know, only because I have my own experience, and I'm referring to, you know, Studio One has been accused, if you've done your homework, of how shall we put this gently, you know, not letting certain people in.
Discriminatory practices.
And I'm just saying, you know, and listen, I was not there five nights out of the week. I had Black friends. I think I went there with them. I mentioned Richard Velasco, who was Latin. It wasn't my experience. So I'm not exactly sure. I know I went there with women. I went there with everybody. So just for the record, my experience, I didn't see it.
Yeah, I've heard that from other people too. And I'm not exactly sure what the origin of those stories is, but I do know I came out a little bit later than you did. My first gay bar experience was in 78. And even at that time, looking back now, I realize that a lot of the clubs that I went to were predominantly white male.
Sure, of course.
It wasn't by design. It's not like I said, oh, let me go out and look for a bar full of white, you know, preppy guys.
No, it's just what it was, yes.
And I think part of it was because the culture in general, the society in general, was still somewhat segregated. You know, there were still issues about busing for schools and things like that. And the racial integration was not as evolved as it is now. And you had people living typically in neighborhoods that were predominantly one race or another.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the way it was. So naturally, if you're going to go to a bar, you're not going to drive 30 miles across town to a bar in a neighborhood you're unfamiliar with. You're going to go to the ones that are close to you and where you live your life every day.
Right.
I don't think, for most of them, I don't recall having discriminatory practices so much as just attracting people that were close to their bar.
It was geographically challenging. Right.
And then you also have the, you know, the nature of what type of music did they play and so on. You know, who was the inner circle of the owners and the managers that attract their own friends and clientele. So I think part of it was unintentional, but of course today everything has to be politically correct and people want to go back and look at things and pick it apart. But I do know that there were a couple of bars nearby that evolved in the shadow of Studio One, including the Circus, which I think went out of its way to be exactly the opposite. I think the Circus was probably very integrated, possibly even minority white, because there were so much of an effort.
The Latin bar. Yeah. It was known as a Latin bar.
So.
But, you know, I think I mentioned this in the documentary. So Scott had I think he was his boyfriend. I don't know. And I can't remember his name. So my memory is failing on this. And this is so scandalous. It's X-rated. So I went home. I didn't go home with him. We went across the street while we were developing the Pacific Design Center and had sex in this building that was being built. And I loved him. He turned out he was Australian, and it also turned out he was Aborigine. And I just remember being completely fascinated by that. His mother turns out that she was a very famous Australian Aborigine poet. He sadly passed away, but I believe he was Scott's lover for a long time. And I had my moment with him, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah. Like I said, I think a lot of it is just people like to go back and find reasons to nitpick what was wrong with gay culture back then, because they felt excluded or because they
exactly
feel it's their flag to wave. And I don't know that that's intentionally was ever the case.
Just my experience was, I grew up, you know, I'm talking about from college on, you know, one of my best friends is African-American, and we met at the factory, not that that was Studio One at the time, but I know he and I, you know, I just, that didn't happen as far as I know. And I just, you know, I think you might be right in terms of the geography being a factor. People might be just disgruntled or unhappy. They were drunk one night and they got kicked out and they've, you know, never gotten over it. That happens.
Now, another bar that you have mentioned to me,
yes,
that was played an important role in your history. And I believe it's the one that you said that you would like to resurrect and go back to, was the Blue Parrot.
It's there. It's still on that corner. I am not a person who tends to. I don't particularly get nostalgic. But if I were, that would be the bar, and only because I used to go there with my best friend. He's no longer with us, and. It was such a great, it was maybe just the time of my life. You know, it was a place where we would go. It was a bar. You could actually hear each other talk. And it had a great logo with a big blue parrot. And it was just, it was a fun, nice bar. This is pre-television sets, you know, everywhere. So I just have pleasant memories of it. But the bar is physically still there. I don't know what it's called now. It's changed names, you know, 20 times since then.
It was called Revolver.
It was called Revolver. Thank you.
I don't know if is Revolver still open. Do you know? Or
I know there is a gay bar in that corner.
I mean, in light of COVID, it's kind of hard to tell because so many bars closed and then didn't reopen or kind of reopened a little bit or, you know, had some changes. So, but the last, I remember it was called Revolver for a while.
It was Revolver. And I do speak, you know, as I said before, if I had only taken pictures, I did. I have it on video, a little video driving down Santa Monica Boulevard during COVID where everything is closed. It was so weird. Unimaginable, actually. And then driving down Hollywood Boulevard, the same thing. No people on the streets at night.
And it looks like Revolver is still open.
Yeah, no, it probably is.
8851 Santa Monica Boulevard. But,
you know, I'm beyond the Silver Lake bars now. I'm looking at Palm Springs.
So, yeah, L.A. had a pretty lively scene back in the day. And even going forward to today, you still see a lot of activity going on in the club scene there. And I understand that Lance Bass is planning to open a new club there.
It's already open. It's been there about 2 years, I believe, 2-3 years.
His bar has? Well, he has Roscoe's. He has Roscoe's.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
But across the street where Rage was,
right?
Supposedly he's opening up a To Die For disco. He said it's going to be the most fabulous dance bar on the planet. So I don't know what that means. They haven't released any details, but he's been working on it for about a year now.
Right.
So,
and I did go to, do you remember what Rage was called before Rage? Because I used to go there.
I do not.
And even more interesting, perhaps, is there was a store that was in the place where Rage became called Propinquity, and I worked there also.
All right, then. So speaking of work, apparently you've also, in addition to your dabbling in graphic design in the early days with Studio One, you evolved into a career of doing graphic design and editing and all kinds of things.
Yes, it's true.
Talk about that a little bit.
All right, well, here's my resume. I have been the art director of Out, The Advocate, Hero, Genre. Is there anything left? In Magazine. I think that's conclusive, in addition to other magazines, but that's my gay magazine resume. I've been creative director or art director for all of those magazines, and I got stories to tell.
Well, go ahead and tell some of them.
Oh, no. They're too skinny. No, when I worked at The Advocate, I worked with an editor named Richard Lard, no longer with us, and a brilliant editor and I don't want to say anything unkind. You know, it was a very interesting period. I believe it was the 90s, like 1990. And working for The Advocate was one of the great years of my life. I worked with a lot of people who remained in that business. And I'm the art director for apparently their best-selling issue, which is the Madonna issue. You know, every gay magazine, I liked working on gay magazines. The other thing I remember about The Advocate that was interesting was when I got there, maybe I'm just such a prude. I got there and I asked all in the art department for them to take down all the naked pictures of men. I wanted to, you know, because I wanted it to have a professional. I mean, look at me in a suit.
You wanted to have a serious.
I wanted a serious environment because, you know, you would have photographers and illustrators.
That's what I was going to say. Did you want it for the fact that you were going to have people visiting the office that you thought wanted to have a more professional
environment? Yes.
Environment.
And you know what? And I also, you know, when I'm working, I don't want to see that stuff. I don't. So they all took it down and no one complained. And the other thing that I did, which it's kind of funny. Oh, so Richard, we did this book. It was called Lust. You can still find it. And one of the unknown stories about Lust is that we put someone on the cover. We'd already printed the magazine and we put someone on the cover. And then they contacted a lawyer and said, "You cannot use my image." And this led to, you'll see where this is all leading to. And that led to me having to fly to New York to make sure that all of the photographers had model releases. And the photographer of this one particular model was I had to go into a hospital because he had AIDS and say, do you have a model release on this guy? Well, we stopped production. We reprinted the cover at great expense. And it's still around. It's called Lust. But Richard's final insult to me was, let's not put our names on. That just gives you a clue as to what our relationship was a little bit like.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know, when you were working at The Advocate, I know one of the guys that I interviewed early on in this series is also from the LA area now. And he used to write for The Advocate too. Bruce Valanche.
Of course.
Was that during your tenure? Was he writing?
No. It's funny because I was with somebody last weekend who ran into Bruce on the streets of West Hollywood. And I told him my famous Bruce Valanche story, which is not relevant here. But no, I'm not sure when he was there. I was really there. It's got to be like 1990. It was very early. And that was... It was interesting because as I was growing up, I used to look at The Advocate, and that is an interesting thing to, you know, one day become the art director of The Advocate.
Now, SoCal Magazine, the magazine that you are now editor-in-chief for,
yes,
that is not a gay magazine, is it?
No, not at all. No, and it's funny because I'm often presented with like, oh, you know, I have a friend, like, should we do a gay magazine? And... You know, the nature of gay life, at least from my perspective, I don't want to do a gay magazine. I've been there, done that. So I don't feel like I really can speak to it. You know what I'm saying? I'm married. I've been with the same person for like 18 years. You see him in the background on occasion. And, you know, although I was in Spain during the summer and I did go to a bar called Boyberry. Interesting. Boyberry. It's very interesting. In Madrid, it's like a bar, and then you go downstairs, and it's like a glory hole bar.
All right, then.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And I wrote, it's actually, you can read about it. Go to SoCal Magazine, because I talk about our Spain trip and my one gay moment there in Madrid, where we, it's late afternoon, and we go into this bar, and you know, we had to go explore. We had to go look. It was, again, it was during COVID. I didn't see anything, but it was interesting. So yes, I'm not particularly interested in doing gay publications anymore because I did so many of them and, you know, so many of them are gone, you know, Genre, Hero, Advocate and The Out are still here. So that was interesting. At Genre, I worked with the very famous Andy Toll, if you know who that is.
When was this?
I worked in 2002, 2003. And Andy, if you're listening, he lives in Provincetown now. He made a lot of money doing a website called Toll Road. And we had a year where our publisher was absent, and it really was the best year of my professional life. Andy remains a rather good looking fella who went to like Princeton. So he had a brain on his head also. And we had a year of putting together a magazine with a lot of famous people working with us. But we didn't have a publisher, and it was such a pleasure to work on. And I literally had some issues here because I was looking at him and I was patting myself on. I tried to call Andy. It was like, Andy, we did such a great job. So that's the end of my gay magazine career.
Yeah, the gay magazines were a lot different, in my opinion, back then. I had taken a position around 2000 in Austin, Texas, as the marketing director for a Swiss designer watch brand that was breaking into the U.S. And they wanted to, you know, to get a little bit more exposure and, you know, get a little bit more editorial coverage out there and what have you. And one of the things that I had done was I had engineered a fundraising project in conjunction with the Elton John AIDS Foundation. Mm. And we raised over $100,000 for Elton John's AIDS Foundation. And subsequently, I was invited to Elton's Oscar party in L.A. So I got to go to both the dinner and the cocktail reception.
All right, I'm jealous.
Which was fabulous because that particular year, NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys were both at the cocktail reception. NSYNC had just broken, they'd shattered the record for, you know, opening week sales for their new record.
Right.
So they were, you know, on cloud nine, and all kinds of extremely interesting Hollywood celebrities and personalities were there. But in connection with that, we also sponsored the Genre Man. Every month,
oh, yes.
In Genre, they used to have a more or less normal representative of the gay community, some guy who had made some accomplishment or something, and honored him with a little spread in there.
And, right.
And we sponsored that program and actually gave each of the winners, it was like a $500 or $600 watch as part right. of their award. But at that time, to me, the gay publishing market was very exciting. Today, I'm not so sure because we're so internet savvy
and right.
so connected to devices that even when I do look at content on gay magazines now, it tends to be online. I don't mm-hmm. actually go to a bookstore looking for them.
Right.
You know, I go to their website and look at them there. So the market has changed quite a bit.
Extremely. And it was at that time, it was very, very exciting because magazines were flourishing. Genre was 2003. Internet was kind of waving at us, but, you know, hadn't kicked us out yet. They moved to New York and lasted, I think, I don't know, maybe 5 years more, and then closed it down. But then again, every magazine I ever worked on is closed down.
Well, you know, that's not as big a deal as it would have been for your grandfather.
No, I know. No, it's like, it's just funny to me because I just, when I look back, you know, my first outing in terms of a magazine was I moved to New York to work for Mademoiselle, a magazine that, you know, clearly is not here anymore. I did work for GQ. I was reminded this week because this is a good story for a good gay story is that I was in the bathroom at GQ and who walks in, but this man had the best smell on him. And I had never seen a human being quite like this. He was tall. He was really, really good looking. And it was John Eric Hexum. And the reason he was in the news is because he put a gun to his head. It was a prop gun, but it was filled with real bullets and he killed himself. And he was brought up in the news again in terms of what's happening currently with Alec Baldwin. But that was GQ. You always, you know, you get in the elevator and, you know, you'd always be with somebody famous. It was very, really, really fun.
So what is down the road for you now? Are you going to be with SoCal Magazine for the next 20, 30, 40 years? Or are you planning a retirement?
I am a self-confessed workaholic. And I don't have any intention of retiring. If I were to move to Palm Springs, I have no intention of picking up golf. I became, you know, what's interesting is to go from an art director to an editor in chief. A few years ago, I'm going to say 6 or 7 years ago, I had an opportunity to become the editor of it's called the LA Fashion Magazine, and it was a really great opportunity to take that position. Turned out, didn't know that I have some leadership qualities, apparently. And so I led, you know, we struggled with it because it really was in that transition period, couldn't get advertising. But to be the editor-in-chief to me has always been, I love design, I love graphic design, I teach it, I still do it, and I still love it, and I write, but being the editor, I don't like to answer to anybody is really my answer to you. So being the editor is really the best because I recently turned 70 and I wrote a piece about what it's like to be. And one of the things that I wrote is that by 70, professionally, you're in a master class And you are, you know, I am, I've never been better. And it's so easy for me to design. And you're in a masterclass. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm explaining it well, but it's just, it's kind of a weird fact that not nervous about anything in my profession. You know, I've been there, I've done it, but I still love it, which is bizarre because I've been doing it for 50 years. And here I am.
So it's kind of like Obi-Wan Kenobi.
It's weird to me.
It's all there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I it's always hard for me to quite grasp, like, what is it? And I just go, you know, it's different. Every day is different. You know, currently I'm working on a redesign of there's a newspaper in Palm Springs called The Desert Sun, and they have a Sunday magazine, and I'm working with a friend of mine, and I've redesigned it, and you know, it's always fun. Redesigns are always fun. I'm not the editor in chief, which is not so much fun, but I really do have this rather eternal love for it too. So to answer your question, I will probably fall over from a heart attack at a computer somewhere.
You'll be writing and designing your own obituary.
I've done that. You know what? Okay, and you have to make me be quiet. That it's funny you say that because, you know, I've alluded to it, but you know, I was in New York in the 80s, and while it was the best of times, it was also an unbelievably horrible time in terms of, this is the beginning of AIDS. This is where people, I went to more, the reason I came back to LA was really to escape it. And I did not escape it. But it was so horrible. And at some point I became sort of I'm not sure what the word is. And it's true to this day where I'm obsessed with obituaries. Because in New York, there was a thing called the New York Native, and you would just open that up because it was like everybody was dying. And I have, to this day, I still do that. I still, you know, and my friends always kid me because, like, if you're watching an award ceremony, it's like, oh, Randy, the memoriam's on. You better get in here.
So unlike the stereotypical mature man who sits around and watches a Weather Channel all day.
Okay.
You would be the one watching the obituary channel or the tribute channel.
If there were such a, hey, that's a good idea, an obituary.
There you go. And if you want to keep it with a gay twist, you know, maybe you can hook up with Reverie TV or somebody and have a memorial channel on there.
But that was I'm happy that I can say, you know, it's funny, the person I've been alluding to, so I grew up with two people. One of them is Joey Arias, if you know who that is. Uh-huh. And we went to college together, and I lived in New York, and the other friend who I mentioned earlier, we're all here, and that's great, great news. But along the way, so many people, I had to walk out the other day. My husband Zoop was playing Mariah Carey, that song, and I actually had to leave the room. It was so emotional to me about people not being here and stuff, and I was like, that one got to me, that song.
Now, those were tough times, but
it was really, really tough. And it's, and I know there's a lot of documentaries about it, and there's been a lot of movies and stuff. You know, I have my own perspective on it because I was there. I was at GQ at the time. My friend Jay Purvis, who never gets mentioned, he was the art director of GQ and Self Magazine. B.W. Honeycutt, who was the art director of Vanity Fair. Among others, they all died. And it sometimes is just a very jarring, horrible memory that, you know, that I lived through what was similar to a Holocaust, I can only imagine. I'm not unscathed. I'm a horrible hypochondriac because of that, I think. But not the kind that goes to the doctor. I'm the kind that doesn't go to the doctor.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to walk down memory lane with us and remind us of some of the bars that were important to you and important to the scene in Los Angeles back 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I hope that things go well for you in the future, and maybe you'll get back into one of these exciting bars and rejuvenate it a little bit once Lance does his magic, you know, out there.
If only I can get a hearing aid where I can hear in a crowded bar with a noisy background.
It might be better not to.
Oh, I don't know. Like, you know, we do have, you know, in Los Angeles, we have that, the Abbey, right? David Cooley's the Abbey. And I don't like going to them because honestly, in a crowded situation like that, I just can't hear. So, I'm more of a samba bossa nova kind of guy. Give me a bar with some Brazilian music. I'm happy.
All right then. Well, thank you for spending some time with us today. And we look forward to seeing what comes up in the next chapter of your life.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at GabeArchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.